Well, over the years, there have been many attempts to try and portray God in art and in films. Apparently, in the first 1,000 years of Christianity, very few artists attempted to paint God, probably out of reverence. And so in the early years of Christianity, if people were trying to represent God, you'd probably see a hand poking out of a cloud to hint at God's presence being there, but without directly trying to portray him. Later, God has been pictured like this, as a kindly old grandfather in the sky. This is a very famous picture from 1645. And you can see the idea there. And in films too, perhaps, there's a lot of films where God is not shown visually, but what you hear is like Brian Blessed, a deep, booming, authoritative voice off screen. So you can hear what God says, but you don't see him. But then later, Monty Python famously caricatured God in this slightly cantankerous and unpredictable cartoon character in their film The Holy Grail. And you might remember, if you're a bit younger, more recently, Morgan Freeman played God in a film. He wore a sharp white suit to play God in a film called Bruce Almighty. My point here with all of this is that the questions, who is God and what is he like? These questions have fascinated human beings all down the centuries of history, haven't they? Who is God? What is he like? And I think it's interesting that even in these examples that we just briefly touched on, we tend to think that God is either high and distant or so familiar that he becomes comical and trivial. It's interesting that, isn't it? Hold that thought, because we'll come back to it later on. But however we might speculate, we began a new series last week by hearing God himself answer these questions. And he answers them in a way that we might not expect. We were in Exodus chapter 34, and we thought a little bit about some of the background. And in these chapters, in a moment of great crisis, Moses, the leader of God's people, cries out to God, "Show me your glory." And if this was a film, and we pressed pause and we played What Happened Next, like they used to do on Kushner Sport, what do you think would happen if God answered that prayer? "Show me your glory." What happens next? We might think of God's glory in big terms. God's eternal nature, his almighty power, his infinite greatness, his vast knowledge. Maybe we imagine mountains and earthquakes and thunder and lightning. Maybe we think of God's glory in those terms. But actually, God answers the prayer of Moses very surprisingly by saying to him, "I will cause all of my goodness to pass before you." When God answered these questions, who is God and what is he like, and answered Moses' prayer, "Show me your glory," when God revealed his glory to Moses, what he saw was the pure and brilliant goodness of God in front of him. God's glory is his goodness. But it wasn't, as we saw last week, it wasn't just what Moses saw, but it was the words that he heard from God. And so in this series, we're digging into a very rich Hebrew word. It's the word hesed in the corner of the screen there, which God, in these verses in Exodus 34, 6 and 7, God uses the word hesed twice in describing himself to Moses. So this is an important word for God to use it twice. And so if we're curious about what God is like, I think it's fair to say from these verses that God himself wants us to grasp, first of all, that he is full of chesed. He is gloriously good, and that means that he is astonishingly kind. This is a God of compassion. We can see some of the words here from Exodus 34. Compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in chesed and faithfulness, maintaining chesed to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. But it turns out that this was not all that God said about himself. And the eagle-eyed among you, one person has already said this to me today, might have noticed last week that we stopped before the end of God's sermon to Moses. After describing his compassion and patience and grace and faithfulness and forgiveness, God adds another truth at the end of verse 7 when he says these words, "Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished, but will visit the sins of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the fourth generation." I think it would suffice to say that there's definitely something more here to God's goodness. God tells us that he is full of compassion, but he also warns us that he will not fail to punish sin. I'm not sure that's a message that we hear even in churches, in our modern culture. I think we want to be very positive and uplifting and upbeat. But this is God's words here, and we have to take them seriously, don't we? So last week, we were right to emphasize that chesed, kindness, is at the very heart of God's character and nature. But I want to develop this idea this week and say that God's chesed must also never be mistaken for weakness. You get that? Chesed is at the very heart of his character, but we must never confuse that with weakness. These verses tell us that God is truly kind, but also not soft. I think this is so interesting. And I wonder whether this is something that deep down we find hard to hear, but actually really long for at the same time. We read these words and we think, ouch, that sounds very serious. And yet, this is something that we want. I think we know, don't we, that true kindness combined with strong and appropriate justice enables human flourishing in a way that only kindness or only strength on their own wouldn't quite achieve. But I think these verses also clash with our cultural sensitivities, because I think for us, kindness has become essentially about being nice and never causing offence. That I think when we think of the word kindness, that's what we've come to think of as kindness. I think we can see that none of us ever want to be thought of as telling someone else what to do, because it feels like this cuts across our individual freedoms. And I think it works the other way too, that we get very sensitive if someone tries to kind of tell us what to do or challenge us in some way, because we can't compute the fact that that might be kind. If someone's challenging us, we immediately feel, how dare you? So I think kindness for us means being nice and not being mean rather than being challenging. And you can talk about this afterwards. I think we seem to have this instinctive aversion to both expressing or accepting any kind of authority, because we assume that any kind of authority has got to be unkind and always bad for us. It is very striking to me here that God underlines his overflowing compassion and kindness in the most dramatic language, but he also makes no apology for being God. He underlines his kindness, but he makes no apology for being God. Now, remember too that God had said to Moses, when he prayed his prayer, "Show me your glory," God said to Moses, "I will cause all my goodness to pass before you." I think in our cultural setting, we can easily see and affirm how the compassion in the first part fits with that display of God's goodness. But the question we're thinking about today is, how can what God says at the end of verse 7 also be part of his goodness? God caused all of his goodness to pass in front of Moses, but he says some things that seem to be contradicting each other in a sense. So we're going to stay in Exodus 34 this afternoon, first of all, to look at this little phrase at the end of verse 7. And I've got three simple statements for us this afternoon that I hope will really help us to think about the rugged strength that is present within the kindness of God to us. And then at the very end, I want to tie our thoughts together by highlighting a verse in the passage that Chris just read to us from John chapter 1. So we'll get to that later. So, kindness is at the very heart of the character of God. But that kindness must never be mistaken for weakness. God's kindness is not weak, but first of all, I want to suggest that it's searingly honest. I think one reason this verse, verse 7, seems hard is that on the face of it, it seems to portray God as ferociously vindictive, even to the point of pursuing a sinner's descendants until he finally catches up with the unsuspecting great-grandchildren. And it jars with us, doesn't it, when we hear that? But I want to just underline straight off the bat that this verse cannot mean that God punishes the innocent for the sins of others. Because elsewhere in the Bible, God says exactly the opposite. If you're making notes, Deuteronomy 24, verse 16, God says this explicitly. And later on in the Bible, in the book of Ezekiel and chapter 18, there's a whole chapter devoted to this idea that each one of us is individually accountable for our own sins and not the sins that other people commit. So we can be clear on that at the very beginning. But there is a sense in which our behavior does have consequences for those around us. In the ancient world, it's hard for us to kind of picture this with our Western eyes, but in the ancient world, I think this reference in Exodus to generations would actually describe a family group who probably all lived in the same house. You get that? It's hard for us to compute that. We've got here grandparents, parents, children and grandchildren who are probably all part of the same clan in living together. But if in this ancient social setting, the leader of such a clan, let's say the leader of such a family group was dishonest or lazy or immoral, or, God forbid, violent. Obviously, that kind of behavior would affect the whole group, wouldn't it? You get that idea? I think the thrust of this passage here in Exodus 34 is not that God is vindictive, but that sin is contagious. That's the point. It isn't that God is ferocious. It is that sin is deadly and influential and contagious. God is clear here that those who are guilty of sin will not escape his attention and go unpunished. But God's kindness also doesn't mean that he just shrugs and says, never mind, if when there's sin in his world. It is true that our sin pollutes and infects and corrupts even others around us. And so it's not that the children unfairly share in the guilt of the parent. And I don't think this is saying that it's inevitable that the children will become what the parents were in a kind of inevitable way. But the truth is, generally speaking, that sin will have a corrosive impact on those around us. I'm reminded of a verse in the New Testament in Paul's letter to the Galatians, when Paul says to the church there, do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man will reap what he sows. I think there's something in that of a similar idea. Our behaviors have consequences, and how we live influences those around us. We lived through COVID not that long ago, didn't we? But I want to suggest that this is an individual and global pandemic that we've never found a vaccine for or been able to cure. We often think that our greatest needs are outside of us. Material things, good friendships, happy family, good health. But I think God here diagnoses our greatest need as being within, actually, our own hearts. Our culture has the idea that if we can just educate people enough and improve our external circumstances, we'll be able to eradicate social problems. But our deepest issues actually are not those that are outside of us. It's the darkness and deceitfulness and self-centeredness and godlessness of sin itself in each of our hearts that blights us. We were praying for Andy Burnham earlier. It is good that we try to eradicate social problems. But I think politicians know that they can't solve the problem of what goes on inside the human heart. I think there are also those in our culture who believe strongly that if we could just get rid of God and lose all the religious things that have repressed us over the centuries, we would all get along better. These things have held us back. But as we're becoming less biblically literate and more secular, it doesn't seem like we're becoming more tolerant or more loving. If anything, society is becoming more tribal and angrier than more peaceful. We could talk about that. Well, I think God speaks into our culture and, in fact, every other culture in history here, the truth that we do need to hear that sin is both serious and deadly. And verse 7 here might well be hard for us to hear, but how is it good? Well, surely, first of all, there is a kindness in God accurately diagnosing our human condition. God has our good in mind when he tells us the truth, unvarnished truth. If you went to the doctor and the doctor hid the truth from you or pretended that everything was okay on your recent scan when it wasn't, you wouldn't describe your doctor as being kind. The truth is that our sin would separate us from God and bring upon us his judgment. And there's no kindness in God not to tell us the truth about our deepest need. But consider this as well. I was thinking about this. If if your enemy says something bad about you or to you, I think they'll always be doing that in order to hurt you, won't they? They'll be seeking to undermine you or slander you or frighten you in some way. Friends, God never tells us the truth about ourselves in order to shame us or to crush us or to humiliate us out of a sense of malice. In his great kindness, God is honest with us so that we'll come to our senses and know the truth and turn to him and trust him to save us and forgive us and heal us and transform us. So searing honesty is the first thing to notice here in verse 7. God's kindness is not weak, but searingly honest. But God's kindness is not weak. It's also, secondly, wonderfully optimistic. So if you've got your Bible open in Exodus 34, if we look a little deeper at these verses, we'll find what I think is one of the biggest numerical contrasts in the whole Bible. In verse 7 that we saw, God speaks of sin impacting three or four close generations. But before this, God has already said that he maintains his chesed, or his faithful, steadfast love, to what? Thousands of generations. So can you see the contrast there? That is a vast difference. So in other words here, even embedded in these very words, even though human sin rightly attracts God's judgment and is so contagious, the truth is successive generations of human darkness has never been able to extinguish the light of God's mercy and grace. Empires have risen and fallen. Generations have come and gone. Human sin has done its absolute worst to be self-destructive. We have traumatic examples of the cycles of this in history, but by God's mercy and power, the light of the gospel has never gone out all down the centuries, and humanity hasn't imploded. It's almost as if sin is like a prolific spreading weed that would dominate and overrun the garden if it could, if God in his mercy didn't cut it back and cause good fruit to grow. God is searingly honest in diagnosing our greatest need, but I think there's also a sense that he's not fazed by it. Oh, I have to be careful saying that. Please don't misunderstand me. It's good that these talks are recorded, isn't it? Please don't misunderstand me. We don't ever want to minimize the darkness and misery of human sin. But the truth is, friends, that in Exodus chapter 34, God doesn't sound depressed. He isn't on the back foot. He is not a kindly old granddad in the sky who doesn't really know what's going on. But neither is he wringing his hands in anxiety or indecision. And there is something to see here about the unconquerable sovereignty of God. History is not a close contest between good and evil, which has an uncertain outcome. God, in his goodness, reigns high above this battle. But neither is this a disinterested, glib dismissal of evil from a God who is aloof and far away and distant. In fact, God is very near, and he has already intervened to transform human darkness. When God says to Moses that he maintains his chesed to thousands, he's preaching the gospel to him. He's preaching good news to him. He's saying to Moses, Despite human sin, it is only the love and power of God that can change hearts and conquer and subdue the darkness of sin that lurks within every one of us. I wasn't the greatest at maths at school, which is a bit embarrassing for a guy who does finance numbers now. I think they all add up. But I did understand at school the idea of symmetry. You study this in maths, don't you? When something's balanced, the two sides are matching equally, aren't they? But isn't it striking here that God, as he describes himself here, this isn't anything like symmetrical. And God, I want you to notice this, God clearly doesn't feel the need to balance all equally. You know, I want to like put love on this side of scale, but we need an equal amount of like my anger against sin on this scale. Imagine if this was the other way around. And in Exodus 34, verse 6, God started by talking about his desire to punish sin for a long time, and then at the end said, P.S., but I still love you. Can you, if this was the other way around? But that's not how it reads, is it? There is hope here in God's words, despite the reality of human sin. And what God is communicating to Moses here is that in his essential nature, he is a vast ocean of compassion and loving kindness. But we must never mistake that kindness for softness or weakness or leniency about sin. God is holy. And he tells us here in his own words that he will not leave the guilty unpunished. But the contagious human darkness will also never be able to extinguish God's love. Sin is serious and deadly, but from God's perspective, this is not a battle that he's slowly losing. God's kindness, God's astonishing kindness is not weak. It's searingly honest. It's wonderfully optimistic. And I want to say thirdly and lastly, it is also perfectly fair. Perfectly fair. Here is one final thing about kindness that I think we do desire. We don't want the sort of kindness that is two-faced, or is easily biased or corrupted. One writer I came across makes the claim, this is a great statement, that in an ultimate sense, God is the one perfectly fair person in the universe. Think about that. God is the one perfectly fair person in the universe. We know that human judges can make mistakes, but God never does, because his wisdom and knowledge are perfect. Human justice can also be bought, but God is incorruptible and sees things always as they really are. He is infinitely and perfectly fair in his assessment. But remember again what we said about the goodness of God. It's as if God says to Moses, you want to see my glory, Moses? Well, here it is. Here is my sheer, unpolluted, infinite goodness. And then God says to Moses, I'm absolutely forgiving sins, and I will absolutely punish the guilty. It sounds like a massive contradiction. But God is saying here to Moses that both those things flow from his goodness. It's not that one of those things is good and the other is bad. Think about it. Why does God want to forgive? It's because he's good. Why can God not brush sin and evil under the carpet? It's because he's good. His goodness drives his love and compassion, but the same exact perfect goodness also drives his perfect and infinite justice. It wouldn't be good for God to allow the guilty to get off scot-free. A God who allows injustice to triumph or evil to go unpunished would be no God. That would be weak, wouldn't it? There's been a little reflection of this in our news this week. I don't know if you spotted this. There's some talk of prisoners who've committed crimes potentially being released early because our prisons are too full. That doesn't seem fair, does it? And the families of the victims of some of the crimes committed are distressed and angry. Understandably, our new Prime Minister has paused this for the moment, presumably to think the whole issue through more fully. It's right there in the news this week, this whole idea, isn't it? We know in our messy experience that it often might not feel that justice is being done or will be done. But there's a powerful reminder here in the Bible that there is an ultimate justice in God, even though we might have to wait for it with a measure of groaning. God is wonderfully kind, but he is not a heavenly pushover. He will not leave the guilty unpunished. So this verse might be hard to read at first, but on deeper reflection in all of this, God tells us the truth. He provides a wonderful remedy, and he always perfectly upholds his divine fairness. So we've been saying that God's astonishing kindness is not weakness, but is truthful, strong and fair. And I've been reflecting on that this week, and these three statements make me think of three different jobs. It makes me think of God in three different ways. First of all, as we've seen, as the best of doctors, who always diagnoses our condition accurately for our good. Second, as a powerful military general who will win the war and bring lasting peace. And then thirdly, as a perfect judge who always assesses things fairly with perfect wisdom and righteousness. God is astonishingly kind, but we must never confuse his kindness with weakness. Now, as a family, we have often enjoyed doing jigsaws together. It takes longer now that it's just me and Jane. There used to be seven of us, and that was a lot quicker. But during lockdown, one of our children, our eldest Rob, who some of you know, got an incredible 6,000-piece jigsaw. And, I mean, in COVID, he got it for his birthday off one of his siblings. And so during COVID, we spent a long time around a massive table putting this 6,000-piece jigsaw together. It took us ages, even all of us. And when we got to the end, there was a piece missing. Absolutely devastating. Isn't that horrible? I don't know whether a dog ate it or someone hoovered it up by mistake. But to get to the end and a piece is missing. So anyway, you feel my pain in that. I'm not bitter. One of the striking things here about God's incredible sermon to Moses, I think, when we read this and reflect deeply on it, is that there seems to be a piece missing. It's simmering under the surface. There's a piece missing. And the dog hasn't eaten it. There's a tension here that can't quite be reconciled. How can God be truthful and strong and fair in his overflowing kindness and yet forgive us sinners. And the real challenge for us, of course, is not that sinners are out there, you know, really bad sinners. The truth is that actually we are all among the guilty. None of us actually truly lives up to God's perfection and holiness. We can compare ourselves with others. None of us have been the people God made us to be. There's a funny story told of an older lady who went to have her picture painted by an artist. And she said to the artist, "I hope you'll do me justice." And the artist was heard to say under his breath, "What you need, madam, is not justice, but mercy." It's a great story. This is the tension, isn't it? How can God's love be expressed so abundantly without his justice being compromised or undermined? I want to suggest that the missing piece in this ancient sermon is Jesus. It's interesting, in Exodus 33 and 34, Moses actually only gets to see the back of God's glory and goodness. Moses wasn't allowed to see the front. God said to him, "No one will see my face and live," because the sight of it would have incinerated him. So Moses kind of gets a glimpse of the glory and goodness of God. But what if one day humans could see the face of God in such a way that it didn't incinerate them? I find it very interesting here that God preaches words to Moses here in Exodus. We've read and seen and heard some of them. But when Chris read from John chapter 1 earlier, we heard John say in verse 14 these words: "The Word became flesh." God preaches words to Moses, but the Word, let the weight of that settle on you. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We'll come back to this in a later talk. But everything God says here to Moses has later become incarnate in a person who embodies it all. John then says, listen to this, "We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of what? Grace and truth." In other words, John is saying, we found the missing piece. We have the missing piece now. We have seen with our own eyes the glory that Moses longed to see but couldn't fully grasp. And when they saw that glory, there was this perfect, overflowing fullness. He came from the Father, what? Full of grace and truth. Do you want to know what God is like? Look at Jesus. He is the missing piece. And if you take him out of the picture, the glory disappears. You will end up with a God who is either all-loving or all-judging, but who can't be both. And if we want a God who simply loves everybody and tolerates everything, that sounds great, but it isn't glorious. There's nothing in that that will ever change your heart or make you go, "Wow, isn't that incredible?" But if, on the other hand, God is 100% judging, you will have no option but to strive and strive and strive perfectly in an attempt to make it. And you'll simply become the kind of person who's trying their hardest to get in. And there's no glory in that either. In the end, it's crushing. If God is either only loving or only just, you will either be complacent or crushed. But if God has found a way to be both perfectly loving and perfectly just, you will be captivated and ultimately changed. We talked at the beginning about different depictions of God in the arts, ranging from the highly reverent to the not so reverent and very trivial. But I think that reflects two very different approaches to God that are both missing something. One is very religious and tries hard, and the other is not religious at all, but he's hoping that if there is a God, he'll be loving and forgive everyone in the end anyway. One is crushing and the other's complacent. But God reveals his glory in a way that enables us not to be crushed and yet not to be lax. You may know that when Jesus was on the cross, he cried out at one point, my God, why have you forsaken me? This happened because Jesus, the one and only, who had been looking into the face of his Father for all eternity, enjoying his glory and goodness, and vice versa, in that moment lost it. Jesus was God forsaken so that we could be forever loved. Justice was done. Guilt was punished as God himself took our place. So our salvation is not achieved by us having to earn it. It's achieved by Christ, and we receive it from him because he is Hesed incarnate. So at the cross we see God's astonishing kindness. And I hope you'll agree that it's anything but weak. Truth, strength, justice all shine there in all their astonishing kindness and blood-soaked, dazzling beauty. Moses' response to just hearing God start the jigsaw was to bow down in worship. How much more should we bow as we see God place his Son as the final piece in there to show us the full extent of his astonishing kindness? According to God, things are much worse than we thought they were. But we are also more loved than we could dare to imagine. And when we see Jesus as the missing piece, as John did, it changes us and enables us to repent and believe and live a new life. Take Jesus out of the picture, and there is no glory. But find him and trust him, and you can taste and see and know God's sin-forgiving and soul-satisfying goodness. And you'll never be the same again.